Thanks for joining us to hear today's special presentation from Hope Central. We trust this message will help you know more about Jesus and inspire you to be more like him.
Our culture, as things that people throw up as potential blocks to their understanding of the gospel. Some of those things are things that people think, like arguments that they don't understand. But there's this one that we're going to handle today that's primarily in the domain of science. There is this almost universal belief in the Western world that evolution is a proven fact. And for people like myself who don't mind a bit of scientific study and like to dig into details and understand some of the more complex arguments, it's been quite a surprise to me to find out how little evidence there actually is for evolution. But yet it's still consistently taught. If you went to a public school, even probably if you went to some Christian schools, you were probably taught the theory of evolution as though it was a fact. But people don't know the details, and because of that, they kind of think, well, isn't it obvious? Isn't everybody know this is true? And it's actually not true. And so we thought it would be really good for us to have a talk today. So I've invited my friend Daniel Wobnitz, who is going to come up now. Come on up, Daniel. Give him a big round of applause. Now, if you recognize his beautiful Russian face, it's because he's oftentimes sitting at the back. He's part of our family here. And I've known Daniel for, go ahead, you can use the pulpit. I'll just use no notes like professional speakers do. Daniel, I've known for about 20 years. He was originally part of my young adults group when I was at Christian Family Center some years ago. And him and his brothers and his whole family, really, are people of incredible diligence and hard work. They're all people of science and education. And Daniel became a lawyer some years ago and practices family law, oftentimes in this area as well. But they really have a passion to understand the Bible through the lens of science and also through personal interest in the subject of evolution. And so I've got a series of questions that I am going to ask our good lawyer friend, because he would never lie to any of us. You know, this has been taken down, right? There's a stenographer in the back. Anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law. Do Australians say that?
They do. Yeah.
Is it sort of something like that? Thank you. Yeah. We've got a police officer in the second row. Oh. You do something wrong, he's gonna get you. I understand that's called pinching, and I don't understand why.
I didn't bring my running shoes.
You didn't bring your running shoes. You're not gonna get away. Don't worry. Listen, I'm gonna ask him a series of questions about things that he's discovered in research, and I'm gonna interplay a little bit just to keep him on track a little bit. But my first question is to you, Daniel. What is the theory of evolution? Because some people may not understand. What is the theory of evolution? What is the sort of the, you know, why do people believe it? What's the pillars of it? Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
I'm just going to start with some definitions. So this may sound a little bit confusing, but then I'm going to break it down and explain it a bit more. So evolution is, to put it simply, a scientific theory. So it's very important. It's not a proven fact. It is a scientific theory. It purports to explain the change in the gene pool of a population from generation to generation by such processes as mutation, natural selection, and genetic drift. A few scientific terms there, but as I said, we'll get into explain it a little bit more simply. So evolution claims that through the cumulative inherited change in a population of organisms, over a long period of time, new species or populations are formed. So just to give you a bit of background, the gentleman in the far corner is Charles Darwin, as many of you would recognise. And prior to 1859, various evolutionary ideas had been proposed to explain new findings in biology, but those ideas hadn't gained wide acceptance in the scientific community. In 1859, Charles Darwin published a book called On the Origin of Species, and in that book he formulated a scientific theory of evolution by a process called natural selection. And that book was based upon his observations that he had made as a naturalist as a geologist and also as a biologist over many years, including a trip that he had taken to South America aboard a ship called the HMS Beagle. And the significance of that book is that it explained natural selection in detail, and in a way that led to wide scientific acceptance of the concept of evolution, and it is considered to be the foundation of evolutionary biology. In that book, Darwin explained that within a particular species or population, there was a significant amount of variation in a gene pool, and that different traits in a species conferred different rates of survival, and those traits were able to be passed from generation to generation. He said that population growth led to a struggle for existence in which favourable genetic variations in a species that were best adapted for the environment and the circumstances ultimately prevailed, whilst others perished. And some of you might recognise that this is where we get the well-known phrase, the survival of the fittest. That last step in Darwin's line of reasoning is the most problematic. He argued that this slow process of natural selection resulted in populations changing to adapt to their environments, and ultimately those variations accumulated over time to form a new species. And this was an inference that Darwin drew. It wasn't actually an established fact, and it wasn't actually a proven fact.
Okay, so basically evolution is the idea that these complex life forms that you and I demonstrate, not everyone else necessarily, but for you and me, these complex life forms that we are today came as the result of billions of years of slow passing on of genetic material from a simple form to a very complex form. Yes. Through a process of mutation, natural selection of favorable mutations, so that ultimately things just kind of got better and better and better until you arrived.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what Charles Darwin proposed.
That's what he proposed. And he did that primarily based on things he saw.
Yes.
Because in his time, there was no genetic research.
No.
And there wasn't anything beneath the level that a very basic microscope could see.
Yes, it was based on many years of observation.
Okay. All right. Okay, so now, it's been a long time. You're talking about, you know, how long is that now? 160 years of time has passed. Is that right? Did I do my math right? Something like that. A very long time. A lot of scientific growth. There's been a lot of testing of this theory.
Yes.
What has modern science kind of found? Like, is there evidence that that he said we should look for that has actually been found in the world, in the actual scientific discoveries that people have been making? Have they found this slow progression? Have they found evidence of simpler forms becoming more complex through time? That kind of thing. Go ahead.
I'll just change the slides. Okay, so Pastor Joe, I think the question that you're asking, is there enough evidence for evolution to be an accepted theory? And as I said, it is important to remember that evolution is still only a scientific theory. It has not been definitively proven as a fact. And yet it is taught today in our schools and in our universities as a fact, as the only possible explanation for how the world came into existence. And some people have even labelled evolution as a scientific religion, in that it does not go anywhere near to providing all of the answers for how life on Earth came in existence. And ultimately, for those who believe in evolution as being the only true explanation for our existence, some element of faith will necessarily be needed in order to explain the serious deficiencies that it contains. In short, there are some real problems with the theory of evolution. It has some fatal weaknesses as a scientific theory that cannot be overlooked or simply ignored. That will bring me to my next slide. Actually, think I've gone too far.
Do you need help? I'm more evolved than you.
My apologies, I've gone too far. This is the slide I was looking for. So, first point I'd like to make is that it's not simply rational to believe that our universe simply created itself out of nothing. I mean, that's a pretty obvious fact. And if you talk to many evolutionary scientists, they recognize this as a serious problem with their theory. The first law of thermodynamics also causes problems for those who adopt the evolutionary theory, in that it implies that the total amount of matter and energy in a universe is a constant. And from this law, we conclude that the matter and energy of the universe must have come from somewhere. Moving on, the second law of thermodynamics. So what that basically is about is that the amount of energy available to do useful work is always decreasing. From this, we can draw two conclusions. Firstly, the universe is not infinitely old, for if it were, there would be no energy left to cause anything to happen now. For example, the sun would not be shining and there would be nothing living on Earth. In other words, the whole of the universe would have experienced what is called a heat death. The universe must have had a beginning when the amount of energy available to do work was at a maximum. And one of the popular analogies that is used, which I've put on the PowerPoint, is that the universe is like a clock which is running down and which has no way of winding itself up again. And therefore, it had to be wound up in the beginning by a greater outside agency.
Okay, so you're saying with that first law of thermodynamics, you're kind of saying that there is this limited supply of, like, that's what the theory is. There is no more time and energy to use, and therefore it has to have been come into being from something. But evolution says that everything came from nothing, that something didn't exist, and then suddenly it did exist, and it's becoming more complex. So evolution then has no theory for example, where did space come from? Where did time come from? Where did light come from? Where did energy come from? Where did mass come from?
That's exactly right.
Okay. So evolution kind of goes back in the human chain, but it can't explain how space or the universe came into being.
That's right.
Okay. All right. And then the second one is that saying that it actually should be running down to a complete stop, that
yes.
There's not more energy being added. There's actually less energy in the system.
Yes.
Okay. And this is about the time that they came up with the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know if you know this, but the Big Bang Theory is actually a fairly recent theory. It's probably found its popularity in the 1970s. But before that, they didn't believe that the universe ever had a time where it did not exist. And now all scientists believe that there was a beginning point for the universe, because where else would everything come from? Okay. Sorry to make your case for you. Okay, now, what about the other things? Fossil record. Darwin said that there's going to be fossil record of simple life forms to complex life forms. And 160 years later, do we have a fossil record that shows that?
What you're talking about is what I've called the missing links. So in chapter 6 of his book, The Origin of Species, Charles Darwin began by saying that in the next three chapters of his book, he was going to be addressing some of the possible objections to his theory. And the first of those objections that he addresses was that often there was no intermediate forms being closely related species found, though his theory implied that such forms must have existed. And in addressing this issue, Charles Darwin wrote in his book, and I'm going to quote from directly from him. Firstly, why, if species have descended from other species by insensibly fine gradations, do we not everywhere see innumerable transitional forms? Why is not all nature in confusion, instead of species being, as we see them, well defined? And that is coming directly from Charles Darwin himself. And what he's saying is that where are the missing links between species? My theory is based upon there being these missing links, but I can't find any evidence of them. If mankind was descended from monkeys, where is the missing link? Where is the half man, half monkey? And Darwin just dismisses this by saying that the so-called missing links were more prone to extinction. But this is still a huge problem that exists for the theory of evolution today.
Okay.
And of course, the real reason why we haven't found the missing links is because they're not there to be found in the first place. Now, sure, there have been all kinds of false claims made in the past about finding a hybrid human monkey, such as the Neanderthal man, who they found in the Neander Valley in Germany in 1856, who was first portrayed to be a semi-erect subhuman. But it's now believed that he was actually a real human who suffered severely from rickets. There have been other claims, such as the Java man and the Piltdown man and the man from Victoria, that they thought was exhibiting the exact behavioural traits of a monkey, who in fact turned out to be a member of the Collingwood cheer squad that had simply consumed far too much alcohol. But the fact remains that no half-man, half-monkeys have been definitively proven to exist. And as Charles Darwin himself said in his book, if this theory were true, there would have been not just one example, not just a rare example, but many, many examples within the fossil record itself.
Yeah, and that's really disappointing to discover for me. As somebody that once believed the theory of evolution, I thought there would be all kinds of evidence, but only to be told later that the things that they made those skeletons out of were bone fragments of maybe a tooth or a bit of a skull cap, and nothing that actually looked like a complete person. Okay, now let's move on. Now, as a lawyer, do you accept this theory as being proven?
Definitely not.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely not.
Thank you.
For one thing, Pastor Joe, if I can get back to this clicker.
Okay.
Oh, there we go. So as you can read up there, the problem with evolution as a theory is that you can't actually test it in order to ascertain whether it's true or not. So as that quote says up on the screen, evolution, at least in the sense that Darwin speaks of it, cannot be detected within the lifetime of a single observer. That was from a doctor of geology and geophysics from the University of Oklahoma. The other problem with evolution is the sheer improbability with respect to it. So, again, I've used the quote from Sir Fred Hoyle, who was an English astronomer, professor of astronomy at the Cambridge University, who rather famously said, "The chance that higher life forms might have emerged in this way is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the material therein." So. And if you need any more evidence to be convinced, why not look at Charles Darwin himself? Prior to his book, The Origin of Species, being published in 1858, so that's 1 year before the publication of his book, in a letter that he wrote to a colleague, a private letter regarding the concluding chapters of that book, he wrote the following. "You will be greatly disappointed by the forthcoming book," a reference to The Origin of the Species. "It will be grievously too hypothetical."
That was very lawyery of you to say it like that.
Thank you. Just trying to emphasise that.
That's good. Thank you.
"It will be very likely to be of no other service than collocating some facts." Didn't quite get the pronunciation of that one.
That's all right.
Old English word that we don't really use too much today. "But though I myself think I see my way approximately on the origin of the species, but alas, how frequent, how almost universal it is in an author to persuade himself of the truth of his own dogmas." So what Charles Darwin is saying is that he is confessing to a particular colleague in the same field of study as himself You're going to be disappointed by my book because I think that it is grievously too hypothetical. In other words, there's a lack of factual scientific evidence for the theory that I'm going to propose. Now, was Charles Darwin here being perhaps modest or humble? I don't actually think so. I think that this he had serious doubts about his own theory, and he had probably no way of fathoming just how influential his particular theory after the publication of his book would ultimately become.
Okay. Now, having demolished the argument for evolution, let's make a case for creation. Let's make a... You know, I want you to just sort of describe why you have become convinced that creation is the evidence that we're being presented with.
Well, first of all, I'm an avid creationist. I passionately believe in the Bible's account of creation. And one of the verses from the Bible that I've found that has absolutely transformed my life and the way that I view the origins of our existence comes from Romans chapter 1 verse 20, which says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." And so, in line with that verse, the science shows that the evidence of intelligent design in creation is overwhelming. To put it another way, God's fingerprints are everywhere. All you need to do is open your eyes, and you'll find the fingerprints of his intelligent design, not just in one place, not just in a few places, but everywhere.
Reach it, brother. Woo.
Yeah.
And it is abundantly obvious that the universe is not the product of mere chance, but created by an intelligent divine maker. So where is the evidence of intelligent design? I'm going to just give you a few very brief examples. Hopefully, I've tried to sort of keep the language simplistic, so
yeah, easy there.
So we're going to talk about the anatomy of an animal cell. So there are about 75 trillion such cells in the body of an average man. Each individual cell is unbelievably complex, as you can see from the picture on the screen. The simplest living cell is vastly more complicated than the most sophisticated giant computer on Earth. Each cell is a world that is brimming with as many as 200 million tiny groups of atoms called protein molecules, and it is a micro-universe in and of itself. Each cell is composed with numerous components, all of which must be present for the system to have any function at all. So this is one of the most incredible and powerful arguments for creation, is that in order to have such a complex system like a cell work, there are so many complicated things going on, all of them which are wholly reliant upon each other.
So what you're saying is none of those parts can work without the parts.
That's correct.
If they're not there, then none of the parts work. So there's no chance for something to come slowly into existence because it must all be there to work.
Yes.
Okay.
So some creation scientists talk about, use the concept of it being irreducibly complex.
Okay.
So that's slide that... So next we're going to talk about DNA, the deoxyribonucleic acid. I can never, ever get that right. For some reason.
Deoxyribonucleic acid.
See, there you go. Should have got you to pronounce.
I am more evolved. I told you this.
That's right. Yeah.
I've got more of them cells up here.
Yes.
I'm just kidding.
So the DNA is unbelievably incredible. So a DNA strand carries the hereditary information from a parent to the offspring in all living things. So it contains the genetic code and determines whether you're going to turn out to be a man, a mushroom, a dandelion, or a dinosaur. So each of the 75 trillion cells in a man's body contains the information that is found in all of the other cells. And therefore, a cell in a man's little toe has all of the data in its DNA for making another man physically identical to himself. During cell division, two strands of DNA, called the double helix, interwoven around each other, separate to form a new cell. It is believed that the rotation during this unwinding occurs at a rate of 75 turns per second. This would be something like attempting in a split second to uncoil and separate a huge cathedral packed from top to bottom with twisted and intertwined microphone cord. But the important part is that when DNA strands replicate themselves, the duplication is so accurate that it would correspond to the rate of error less than one letter in an entire set of Encyclopedia Britannica. It is a simply remarkable mechanism. And could it be the product of mere chance or a supreme genius inventor?
And so when Darwin came with theory, he knew nothing of DNA.
That's exactly
Nobody
right.
Nobody knew anything about DNA.
That's exactly right. It was there was a whole series of experiments that were conducted after he had left the scene.
Yeah. So, but in DNA, which is, you know, we see on all these crime shows how someone is proved to have been at the crime site, because DNA is very, very precise, isn't it?
It is. It's unbelievably precise.
Yeah.
And you think about how many times the DNA has to replicate and duplicate itself, and yet the duplication, the information, the genetic code that is being transferred at a remarkable rate of accuracy.
And all of that information that's in there, an evolutionist believes, came from a chemical that existed separately and then got this information equivalent to an Encyclopedia Britannica in this tiny thing, accidentally or through mutation.
Through pure accident, pure chance.
Okay. Any chance of that?
No.
Okay.
Okay, next we'll move on to the human eye. So it is the mechanics behind the human eye are truly remarkable. As you can see, our eye has a pupil to admit light. It has an iris that can enlarge or contract the pupil in order to control the amount of light that enters into your eye. It has a lens in order to focus light on the retina, which is full of photoelectric cells that convert the image to electric signals. Now, essential for the eye to work is the transparent window, which you can see there. It's called the cornea. That is a very unique type of tissue in that it has no blood supply. It obtains its oxygen directly from the air. It has a certain very finely arranged structure of corneal fibers, which in turn requires complicated chemical pumps to make sure that there is exactly the right amount of water content in your eye for you to be able to see. The retina is a very thin layer composed of photosensitive cells. It can detect a single photon of light. So it's impossible to actually improve on its sensitivity. The eye works marvelously in a wide variety of light intensities, from hardly any light to very bright light. And in technical terms, it has a dynamic range of 10 billion to 1. And what that means is that it will still work well in an intensity of 10 billion photons of light. Now, just to give you a comparison, modern photographic film has a dynamic range of only 1,000 to 1. So even specialist equipment hasn't come anywhere near to the dynamic range of your eye. Another amazing design feature of the retina is that the signal process that occurs even before the information is transmitted to your brain. This occurs in the retinal layers between the ganglion cells and the photoreceptors. For example, a process called edge extraction enhances the recognition of the edges of objects. And research into the retina shows that that 12 different types of ganglion cells send 12 different distinct representations of a visual scene to the brain for the brain's final interpretation. One representation is mainly a line drawing of the edges of the objects. Others deal only in motion of a specific direction, and still others transmit information about shadows and highlights. And how the brain integrates these representations into the final picture is still the subject of an intense investigation. Moving on to that, there's only a small part of your eye in the centre, which makes up less than 1% of your eye, called the fovea, which has a very high resolution detail. It sees the central 2 degrees of your vision field, or about twice the width of your thumbnail at an arm's length. It has a higher density of receptors, and it needs a much area of our brain to process its information, over 50% of the visual cortex. But most of the eye's area is used for peripheral or non-central vision, which has a much lower resolution, and therefore needs less brain processing power. Normally, the low-resolution parts of the eye detect objects of interest, and our eyes have unconscious motions that aim our foveas at these objects, and this is the way that we can see details of a wide area with minimal brain computing power. So why not simply have the whole retina in sharp focus? Because there is no point in having much detail unless the brain can process it. And our brain would need to be 50 times larger to process such information. And it would only give you a minute advantage over the current system, where the peripheral area can pick out possible areas of interest and then zoom in the fovea to analyse more closely, using much less brain processing power. So what that actually means is that the actual design features in the eye are both... There's features within your eye, also linked to your brain, that are optimized in order to use the most efficient form of brain processing power. And so from that, we can arrive at the following summary. There is no way that a blind eye maker made eyes, which is what the theory of evolution says. And even the simplest of eyes needs so many complex components functioning together for any vision to occur. If you had trouble in just following what I just read out to you about the human eye, that is only a very basic summary of the design features. There are a huge amount of complex detail contained within your eye that allows you to see. And lastly, there is absolutely no evidence for the origin of any more than 30 different eye designs by common ancestry. So what that is about is that there are other creatures who have different eye designs, such as the chameleon, that have large eyes that move independently and use a telephoto principle in order to measure distances, and then also lobsters have a totally different method of forming an image from other creatures. They have tiny facets that are perfectly square in nature, and the eye focuses light by reflection.
So your eyes, super complex.
Unbelievably complex.
But there's no reason that any part of it would work if all the parts weren't there.
That's exactly right.
And every part is super complex.
Every part is unbelievably super complex.
And it would have to evolve on its own by pure chance. But then even in the evolutionary tree, there's 30 different unrelated forms of this mutation, so to say.
That's exactly right. There's not just one eye design that fits all.
Yeah.
There are 30 different designs for eyes.
Yeah. Okay, so not likely.
Not likely.
Okay. All right. We're just going to have to speed up on these last couple examples.
Okay, there. All right. Well, we're going to just briefly... wanted to talk to you just very briefly about ants, because ants are amazing creatures of great industry. They carry objects that are 50 times their own body weight, and they are amazing creatures. Can I ask you the question, have you ever come across a lazy ant? Have you ever come across an ant by the side of the road who's refusing to do work because he's claiming that it's his rostered day off?
Yeah.
And that is why in the Proverbs, Solomon says, go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. Ants are amazing creatures, but they do exactly what they're designed to do. So the next slide, we'll talk about metamorphosis. Which is an amazing transformation where a caterpillar transforms into a butterfly. So a caterpillar, right from the outset, has everything necessary to reinvent itself into a butterfly. It comes fully equipped with a complete set of do-it-yourself plans labelled how to turn into a butterfly. And the reason why this particular transformation is a problem for the evolutionist is because their whole theory is based upon transformation happening over a slow period. Whereas with a caterpillar transforming itself into a butterfly, here you have a very sudden, a very distinct transformation that occurs within a relatively short period of time. So just moving on even further, I wanted to just end with this particular verse, which is a favourite of mine. So the last evidence that I want to put forward to you of intelligent design are the stars and the planets in our sky, all of which are on an amazing grand scale. The Bible says that day and night they declare the glory of our Creator. So in Psalm 19:1-4, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the end of the world.
Is that it?
That is.
Well, then you guys need to give Daniel a very big round of applause. Amazing, wonderful, and thank Daniel and his wife, Zhenya, for all of this time that they got to invest in this. I just want to finish, if you could just advance my slide there, Daniel, about this great dilemma. It's very important for us to search things out. It's not a bad thing for us to try to discover truth, but the problem is that we then come up with theories that may not be backed up with the reality that you see around us or the evidence that's presented by God in his own word. And I think it's very important for you and I, for us all, to understand that we are all facing questions bigger than we're capable of understanding. But these questions are meant to lead us towards God, not to cause us to ignore God. Here in the book of Acts, when Paul was talking, he said, "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and of earth, does not live in temples made by man." So he's talking about how religion is pointless. "Nor is he served by human hands, nor does he need anything, since he himself gives to mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined the allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us. My friends, I don't know where you're at in your own faith journey, and I don't know, but I'm hoping that today, that if you are a person that's questioning the reasonability about God, that you've heard from this evidence that there is a significant truth to the need for there to be a God. There must be something behind all of this. We talked very briefly, and Daniel showed a picture of the rings that are around a planet. And from that, we were looking with telescopes farther and farther and farther and farther into space, trying to discover the meanings and the origins of things. And every single one of these points back to the fact that someone began this. Someone started us. And that's why the Bible talks constantly about us being creations. You are a creation. And that means that you have a relationship with your Creator. That he made you for his purposes, and he wants to have a relationship with you. And so in all of the searchings that you're doing, what Paul says is that let those searches bring you closer back to God. If I could have the worship band just come, we're just going to finish in a moment here with a prayer, and then an invitation for us to experience this closeness with God. I don't know if you know much about modern science and stuff like now, but now because of the Big Bang Theory and it's all of its specialness that everyone wants to know stuff about, they've been doing measurements across the galaxies and the universe trying to figure out stuff. Has anybody ever heard of dark matter? Yeah, dark matter is what somebody came up with because when they added up the weight of the universe, it didn't weigh enough. I don't know. You get on the scales, you probably think, hang on a second, that's too much. But when they weighed the universe didn't weigh enough. And so they went, well, there must be missing components that we can't see. If you add up all of the matter in the universe, there is still a huge amount that's missing. And how do you know that? Because weight, gravity, things pull on each other and they make sense of things. They pull things back towards themselves, and there's nothing that would hold the universe together in the form that it has without some mysterious thing called dark matter. So they began to search and search, and they built under Switzerland a great place called the Large Hadron Collider, where they accelerate electrons to near the speed of light so they can smash them into each other so that they can discover dark matter. They've spent billions and billions of dollars to try to find out what makes this work. I want to tell you and save you a lot of billions. God made it work. And he wants to make your life work too. Because the same power that created the universe is the power that makes human lives work. You're living, you're breathing, that's not enough. You need the power of God in your life so that you can live. So I'm going to ask us all just to stand to our feet. And I'm just going to ask, if anybody needs that power of God, that touch of God for any reason at all. When we pray for people, we see God do tons of things. When Jesus was on the earth, his power came out and did all kinds of fantastic things for people. But today, maybe you've, in this talk, you've become more convinced than ever, and that you actually find there's this faith growing inside of you that Jesus is what you're searching for. Jesus is your creator, and he wants you to know him, and he has done everything so that you can be forgiven and come into a relationship with him. And if you would like to know Jesus yourself, then I want to ask you to just step out, to come down to the front and let us pray with you. Let us lead you into a prayer so that you can know this Creator yourself personally. So even as I'm just talking, maybe you just want to start coming out now. Just come out and you say, I'm just convinced, and I want someone to join with me in prayer. I get a sense too that there's other people here today that you've faced a lot of confusion. There's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of trouble, there's a lot of things in your life that have pulled you away from God as the center. A lot of problems or questions or things or confrontations that have led you away from God being your source, and you're finding yourself weakened by that experience, we would love to see God bring certainty to your life. So maybe you're a person that's really struggling with questions, with trouble, with confusion in your life. Why don't you step out too and let us pray with you? Come on down even now, just even as I'm speaking. Why don't you come? And I'm just gonna get the worship band to lead us in a song. And I want you to search out your heart, because God's gonna do some miracles here today in our lives. So why don't we join together? Let's lift up God's name. Let's worship Him, our Creator and our good God. And I'm just gonna come and exhort us once again. And maybe Glenn, maybe you want to pray with our brother there. And if there's anyone else seeking, you need that answers, you need that love, you need that anxiety put away, then why don't you come even as we sing? Thanks, guys. Simone, why don't you lead us? Thank you, Lord.
Thanks for listening to this week's message from Hope Central. We hope you'll stay connected with us. Visit our website, hopecentral.org.au, and follow us on Facebook, Hope Central SA.